Hello, it's Tony Martinetti, Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Oh, feels good. Very good to be back in the studio after 3 weeks hiatus from the studio. Oh, I hope that you were with me last week. I'd go into ischemia if I learned that you had missed getting to the next level. Lawrence Pagnoni is the author of The Nonprofit Fundraising Solution. Based on his work as an executive director and fundraising consultant, he had proven strategies to get you to the next level of fundraising revenue. This week, it's The Ethics of Asking. Professor Denny Elliott from the University of South Florida edited the book, The Ethics of Asking. When have you got an ethical issue in fundraising and how do you resolve it? How helpful are the professional ethics codes? We'll talk about examples from her book and take your questions. If you're listening live, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag nonprofitradio. On Tony's Take Two, 5 reasons to promote the IRA rollover now. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Denny Elliott. She is a director and professor in the Department of Journalism and Media Studies at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg. She holds the Poynter Jameson Chair in Media Ethics and Press Policy and is the campus ombuds. She's written more than 190 articles and book chapters. That's a hell of a lot. My bio lists the number of words I've written. This is very impressive. She has authored, co-authored, edited, and co-edited books, including Ethical Challenges, Building an Ethics Toolkit, Ethics in the First Person, and The Kindness of Strangers, Philanthropy in Higher Education. Her writing and her thinking brings her to the show. Professor Denny Elliott, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Are you in Florida at the moment?
I am, enjoying the winter weather of Southern Florida.
We've got the winter weather of Southern Florida up here in New York, practically.
Oh, well, that's good.
It's a little too warm up here. You do a lot of thinking about ethics and fundraising. How can we distinguish ethics from law?
I'm sorry, how can we distinguish ethics from...
law, the law, legal?
Oh, from law, yeah. You know, that's an interesting thing, and it's not that I just do a lot of thinking about ethics. In my position as department head, I'm involved in fundraising in one way or another to bring some sort of needed resources into the department, and as I ran two ethics centers, at one at Dartmouth and one at the University of Montana. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I once felt like a combination of smoke and mirrors. I'm pretty familiar with the day-to-day down and dirty part of fundraising, too. So it's not just a matter of thinking about it, but it's a matter of thinking about what one is doing in practice. And how it differs from the law is that in philanthropy and fundraising, like with most of the other areas in our lives, law defines a minimal standard. That if you drop below that minimal standard, that you can be held accountable by statute generally for your actions. But ethics asks you to think beyond that. Ethics asks you to think about what's the right thing to do in a whole sphere of what's ethically permitted actions.
The law is much narrower, as you're saying. There are lots of things that are legal but would transgress a standard system of ethics, I think.
Yeah, sure. My favorite example is just a real straightforward everyday example for all of us, and that's, now if you think about truth telling and lying, you can count pretty much on one hand the situations in which the law prohibits you from lying. You know, you can't lie on your income tax forms, and you can't lie when you're a witness on the stand in court, but for the most part, we're pretty honest people. If somebody stops me on the street and asks me, what time, it says according to my smartphone, I'm going to tell them the truth about the time as I know it to be. I'm going to be truthful with my students and with my friends and colleagues, and that's all in the realm of ethics. That goes way beyond what the law requires me to do.
where does morality fit into this?
Well, you know, that's kind of a conversation probably for maybe even a different kind of radio show, in that for more than 2,000 years of Western moral philosophy, we've been thinking systematically about the nature of how it is that people should and should not treat one another. The word ethics comes from the Greek ethika, meaning custom or convention or how we expect people to treat us. And the word moral comes from mores, again, the Latin word for custom or convention and how we expect people to act. And so, you know, I guess what I'm saying is fundamentally, there's really not a difference between, at least between how I will be using today ethics and the word ethics and the word morals. I know some people say, oh, well, morals has to do with religion or sex, and ethics is what you do in the workplace. I spend a lot of my time trying to integrate our lives and make sure that that I can help people think about how to be the same good person regardless of what role they happen to have on at the moment. And so I tend not to make an arbitrary distinction between moral and ethics. Some professors have some philosophers have over the past 2,000 years, and some haven't.
Okay. Well, when we have those people on, those who are still living, then they can make that distinction. But okay, thank you. And the topic of the book, The Ethics of Asking, that we're talking about is your concerns about how fundraisers persuade people to give.
Right. Yeah, I think that when we talk about fundraising, or actually let's even talk just about the act of giving, mm-hmm. of donating one's extra resources to create public good, as that person sees it, that act is a supererogatory act. It goes beyond what somebody is minimally required to do. And so I think that when we are working with people who are doing acts that are above and beyond what is minimally respected, minimally expected of folks in private and public life, that there are special considerations and special obligations that folks have toward the givers, toward the folks who are donating.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we'll talk about some of those special obligations. How does a person who is a fundraising professional know that they are facing something that is an ethical issue?
Well, first of all,
what does that look like? What does it feel like?
Okay. Well, first of all of us every day face ethical issues, and we generally don't think about it because we don't have to. I don't have to think about, to use my example of a stranger asking for time or directions, I don't have to think about, oh, do I want to lie to this person or not? Of course, I'm just going to tell them the truth. And so I think that the only time that ethical issues sort of come to our consciousness or our awareness is when we feel like we're caught between loyalties or caught between expectations, or caught between doing something that seems best for our personal self versus doing something that seems better for another.
Hmm. Okay, and in those conflicts of loyalties, that could be us as individuals, as you said, or could be our institutions also. A conflict between
the
institutions and what may be best for a donor.
Right. Fundraisers have an interesting complexity of obligations. In my fundraising role as department chair, for example, I have obligations to the department and to the university as a whole. But at the same time, when I put myself in a position of trying to extract resources from people who aren't required to give them to me or to the university, to the department, I take on new and special obligations to them as well.
All right, we're going to talk about some of these obligations, et cetera. We have to take our first break, and when we come back, Denny, Elliot, and I will continue talking about the ethics of asking. Hang in there.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Do you need a business plan that can guide your company's growth? Covenant 7 will help bring the changes you need. We are small business consultants, and we pay attention to the details you may miss. Our coaching and consultant services are guaranteed to lead to right growth for your business. Call us at 917-833-4860 for a no-obligation free consultation. Check out our website at www.covenant7.com.
Are you fed up with talking points rhetoric? Everywhere you turn, it's left or right spin, ideology, no reality. In fact, it's ideology over intellect. No more. It's time for the truth. Join me, Larry Sharp, a.k.a. The Neo-Sage, Tuesday nights, 9 to 11 Eastern, for the Ivory Tower radio program. In the Ivory Tower, we'll discuss what's important to you, society, politics, business, and family. It's provocative talk for the realist and the skeptic who want to know what's really going on, what does it mean, and what can be done about it. So gain special access to the Ivory Tower and listen to me, Larry Sharp, your Neo-Sage, Tuesday nights, 9 to 11, New York time. Go to ivorytowerradio.com for details. That's ivorytowerradio.com. The Ivory Tower is a great place to visit for both entertainment and education. Listen in, Tuesday nights, 9 to 11. It will make you smarter.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. You should know that we are sponsored by two companies. We're sponsored by Rallybound, which is peer-to-peer fundraising for runs, walks, and rides, and also welcoming new sponsor, TBRC Cost Recovery, getting you money back from phone bill errors and omissions. And I'll have a little more to say about both of them toward the end. Denny, you don't mind if I call you Denny, right? It doesn't have to be Professor Elliot, does it?
No, Denny is fine,
okay,
Tony.
Cool.
Thank you.
All right. Now, you edited this book. How does that work? Everybody else does all the writing, and then you just say, we need some commas and paragraph breaks? I mean, how does that work when you're...
Oh, I wish.
What is that role? How does that look like?
After editing some books and writing some books and co-authoring some books, I've decided that actually being sole author of a book is probably the easiest route out of all of those.
Really? How does this work?
With editing a book, the editor is in charge of the overall theme and the big idea of the book. As you know, in Ethics of Asking, there are a variety of chapters on different aspects of fundraising, including planned giving and prospect research
campaigns,
fundraising, I think is what I call it.
Capital campaigns,
but
also.
As editor, I was in charge of the overall idea of finding the right people to write or collaborate with me on specific chapters, and then actually the tough part is getting them to get things done on deadline, and then rewriting and revising chapters so that there was a flow to the book, so that it feels like the chapters go together, even though they were written by different people with different backgrounds and different ideas.
Okay, I did get that feeling. All right, so that's your responsibility as the editor. I thought the book publisher would do that for you. No, that's you.
No, book publishers don't do much these days, except actually get them out, and with any luck, do a little marketing.
Okay. This fundraising that we're talking about, fundraising is essentially building relationships. So your concerns are around how or some of your concerns around how professional fundraisers are going about that?
Yeah, you know, and it happens at so many different levels. I'm thinking, all right, for example, with planned giving, most fundraisers would really like to tap into funders who have an opportunity to bequeath estates or, you know, some substantial capital or property. And that is usually brokered by an external third party, an investor, an attorney, somebody who both represents the interests of the giving client as well as works with potential sites for the gift. And so, what the relationship is between the organization that serves to benefit and the middleman, the third party there, is often a point of conflict. Prospects research can be an ethical issue in that I know from my days, not just at this institution but at other institutions of higher education, that I never met with a potential donor without having a whole dossier on that donor and on what our development office had decided the person was capable of giving, on much personal information regarding that person. And I always felt a little uneasy in that it was not clear to me. I mean, it was clear to me that as an agent on behalf of the organization, I certainly shouldn't say, "Oh, Mr. So-and-so, I don't know if you are aware that I'm aware of, of your three divorces, et cetera, et cetera." I knew better than to do that.
Yes.
But at the same time, I thought, what would he think if he knew that I had all of this information on him and was just not telling him that I had it? So that's the prospect research level. And then there is the relationship level. As people give to people. And so the idea of building a relationship with potential givers is an important piece of it, but I think it's really easy for potential givers to misunderstand the intentions of a fundraiser. I think it's easy for fundraisers to move into what I would call a seduction phase. And that may or may not be true sexual seduction, but the move from fundraising, where the giver, potential giver, and the development person are both working with common interests for the organization, is a different matter, I think, ethically speaking, than a situation in which the fundraiser is trying to woo the potential giver.
Wow, there's so much there that you just laid out. Planned giving is the consulting that I do and have done for 16 years. Prospect research, we have a regular contributor on the show who talks about prospect research once a month, Maria Semple. And the relationships, that is hitting home because I've been a fundraiser for 16 years. And in planned giving, you deal with people who are often in their 70s, 80s, and often widowed or widowers. Sometimes it's hard. I mean, let's talk about the last of the three things that you just laid out, because that's the one that hits home most poignantly for me. I've been in lunch situations. I don't like to meet prospects over dinner, and I know that we're going to talk about language, and that term prospect is a little off-putting to you, and we'll get to that.
Yes.
So I'll adopt your language and say, I don't like to meet potential donors over dinner. It's just something, that evening hour just feels like it's over the line for me.
Intimate.
Yeah, that's right. Dinner is more intimate. It can be, and you want to eliminate any possibilities of that. So always lunch, but I do like doing over meals. I do like meeting potential donors over meals and clients over meals too.
And why is that?
Because there's a shared, we're sharing a space, we're sharing a meal. We might, depending on the person, we might actually be sharing an appetizer sometimes. That's not too often, but sometimes. So there's that sharing of the physical space and the activity around at the physical space. Also, it's a flow that we all know. We all know that the server is going to bring water, and then I'm gonna always ask for water with no ice because that's my so. But once we get that over, then the server's going to leave us with the menus, and we're going to have a few minutes, and then we know the server's going to come back, and then the server's going to bring the starters, and then the server's going to clear those and bring the entree, and we'll have about 5 minutes or 7 minutes or so between the starters and the entree, starters ending and the entree. So there's a common understanding of the flow as well as the sharing of the space and the sharing of the meal.
Right, and actually, one of the things that I'm hearing you say in this, and if you don't mind, you sort of picking this apart
a little bit. No, it's good.
There are a couple of things that are going on there. That when you're in a situation in which you're asking somebody to do something that they don't have to do, which would be a potential donor. That one of the things that you're doing is setting up a scene that has a comfortable and known flow and ritual,
mm-hmm.
and so the idea is that you don't have, neither you nor the potential donor have to think about the context, and so it creates comfort and I'll say a shared intimacy in the fact that you're both comfortable with that. Now, if you're meeting somebody over a meal who is coming at this from a different culture, where it may be that the rituals are not quite the same or a little at odds, it might be fun and exciting, but it's going to be a different feel than something where you're meeting with somebody from your same culture and where you know that the ritual is well known. The other thing about meeting over a meal is that there is something metaphorical and symbolic about the idea of eating, of nourishing one another. If you're picking up the check, you are certainly nourishing, you're feeding that person. And that is a highly symbolic act of nurturing and caretaking. And so what you're doing is showing the potential donor that you're going to take good care of her, in the process of this transaction. You're also making a very strong point that this is not a business meeting. If I need to sit down with somebody and I know that there's something difficult to talk about, a meal is really not the place to do that.
Well, something difficult that requires privacy, right? Although I would say in New York, I know some restaurants that have quiet spots, but still might the potential donor or the donor. I might even be thanking someone, so it might not be asking someone to consider a gift, but I might actually be thanking someone on behalf of the client. But there are situations where I wouldn't, and if I know it's going to be a difficult conversation, then I wouldn't do it in any public place, restaurant or otherwise. But I think you can do business. You said it's not a business context, but I think you can do business over a meal. You don't think
so? You can do business over a meal, but it creates a different kind of interaction, a different kind of relationship. And just as an example, if I have a graduate assistant or a graduate student who is obsessing over her thesis at the moment and is in a tough spot, I'm very likely to take her for a cup of coffee. And we'll sit and have a cup of coffee and talk about the situation. But just the fact that I've gotten her, in a comfortable place, I'm nourishing her, I'm giving her, getting her a cup of coffee, and we're sharing that sustenance together is going to create kind of an openness and a readiness that is different than if I'm meeting with a student about a problematic grade in my office. I'm creating a different context. And so when I want a student to sort of relax and be open and, be more ready to listen to what I have to offer, I'm going to feed them something.
Okay.
And that's what I'm suggesting you're doing with potential donors.
Yeah, you're suggesting that I'm duplicitous. That I'm
no.
No. Oh, okay. No, it sounds like I'm a little like I'm a little devious. Is that?
No.
Okay.
I do think that fundraising gets devious, and I really would like to talk about that specifically. But don't take offense. I'm not saying you're unethical.
Offense. No. Oh, I've been called much worse than devious. No, but it sounds like you're suggesting that some people do it for a different reason than the reasons I'm suggesting I do it.
Like, actually, I'm suggesting that you've got all the right instincts. What I'm saying is that
this is coming,
what your behavior shows.
Wait, say that again? I'm sorry. Say it again?
What I'm saying is you have all the right instincts
right.
as a fundraiser, that you want to get the potential donor someplace where the person feels relaxed and comfortable, is sharing something with you, and is getting something from you, which automatically creates a response of giving back.
Yeah, that's the part that I don't think of, that I'm giving to them, really, with the organization's dollars. I'm not the one personally picking up the check, but that's not the part. I'm not thinking of that. I'm giving to them, so they should be giving back. I think this, you know, does this come down to character? Some fundraisers might take people out for meals with that intention, with that thought that I'm giving to them, they need to give back. So does this come down to personal character?
No. I don't think so. I think that what you're saying is that you do it just because you're a naturally good guy, which I certainly believe you are, and that's a matter of character. Whereas people who do this intentionally to manipulate the donor, you know, get the donor a glass of wine, let her, you know, feel relaxed, and you know, and so on, that maybe there's something that shows less character in that.
Yeah.
I would say that every fundraiser has the responsibility to think about how every professional act is perceived and or is likely to be understood by the potential giver.
That's very helpful, I think. We have just a couple minutes before we take another break. We solicited questions from listeners, and we got a bunch. I'm gonna throw one at you from that we got from Facebook. This is Kelly on Facebook. You're in the middle of a capital campaign, and the organization's plans change. Your executive director thinks the changes are no big deal. Do you notify donors who committed funds to the original plan, or follow the executive director's lead, which would be keep it quiet?
Well, first of all, I think that I would wonder about an organization that changes something significant in a capital campaign midstream. That you know, one hopes that a campaign doesn't get announced until about 50% of the money is raised or pledged, and that you know that pretty much every detail has been tested out on a variety of audiences first. But so you find yourself in that situation. I think that any donor that has made a contribution, that if the intent of the donation can't be met, that there is an ethical and probably in most places a legal obligation to make it clear to the donor how things have changed. And obviously moving forward, you need to be honest about where things are now and where they're going.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, Tony's Take Two. We've got some live listener love and more conversation about the ethics of asking with Denny Elliott. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
Hi, I'm Austin Marola.
And I'm Sloan Wainwright.
We're the hosts of the new Thursday morning show, The Music
Power Hour.
At 11 a.m.
We're going to have fun.
And shine the light on all aspects of music.
And its limitless healing possibilities.
We're going to invite artists to share their songs and play live.
We'll be listening and talking about great music from yesterday to today.
So you're invited to share in our musical conversation.
Your ears will be delighted with the sound of music.
And our voices. Join Austin.
And Sloan.
Live Thursdays at 11 a.m. on TalkingAlternative.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Hi, this is Claire Meyerhoff from the Plan Giving Agency. If you have big dreams but a small budget, you have a home at Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio.
So glad to be back in the studio because I can send live listener love. New York, New York, New Bern, North Carolina, Reston, Virginia, Houston, Texas. Live listener love out to you. Quebec is checking in. We got Montreal and Palmerol. Maybe I pronounced that very badly, but you're in Quebec. If you're in Quebec and you're not in Montreal, that's the name. Yours is the town that I'm trying to pronounce. Welcome. Of course, we've got listeners in China, Chongqing, Shanghai, Nihao. Seoul, Korea, always checking in, always appreciative of Korea. Annyeonghaseyo. And there's more live listener love coming. Tony's Take Two, my blog this week is 5 reasons to promote the IRA rollover now. For your donors and potential donors who are 70 and a half years or older, this IRA gift opportunity ends on December 31st. It's been extended a couple of times, but I wouldn't bet on Congress for any purpose, including charitable giving being extended. So I'm not too optimistic that this will be extended again. I'm assuming with all my clients that it's going to end on December 31st. It's a very easy way for donors who are the right age to make their year-end gift to you. It's very easy to promote, and I've got promotion ideas on the blog. It's also easy for donors to execute. They just fill out a simple form that their IRA custodian has. All they need is your organization name, address, and tax ID number. And that's part of what makes it so easy for you to promote. Not a lot of explanation. If you have potential donors who are the right age, I suggest you work the IRA giving opportunity into your year-end fundraising plan. And there's a lot more detail on that on my blog at tonymartinetti.com. That is Tony's Take Two for Friday, 15th of November, the 45th show of this year. Denny, do you mind if we take another listener question?
Of course not.
This came from Booster Advisor on Twitter. What are your thoughts on hosting a fundraising event for people you don't know who experience a tragedy? I mean, the Booster Advisor, the person may be thinking about maybe people in the Philippines or something like that. Any issues around raising money for people who you don't know, who you know have suffered?
I'm not exactly sure what's behind the question, so let me take a couple of different stabs at it. I think it's fine to raise funds for people who have experienced traumatic events wherever they are in the world, and I think that there are often questions about how those funds are being managed, both in country as well as in the process of getting them from donors here. Assuming that those management details are worked out, I don't see a problem with doing that. So I guess I'm kind of searching for what other ethical issues there might be.
Okay, you don't really see this as that much of an ethical issue. I mean, the way the manages,
I see it as a management problem.
Management and legal in terms of management of funds that are intended for charitable purposes. The law has a fair amount to say about that. Okay.
Right. And I've done not very popular work on breast cancer charities and how it doesn't support services that are being implied, although maybe not specifically said, and how breast cancer charity websites make it very easy to donate and very difficult to find services. So I think that one can raise money legitimately for any number of things, but I think that the process of fundraising incurs an obligation to the potential donors that money is going to be managed appropriately as the donors intended, and that the donors are very clear on what percentage of the money is actually going toward the charity. As compared to, say, administrative costs.
Let's talk about this use of the term prospect, which, as I mentioned, you have a chapter in the book devoted to language. What is it about that term that turns you off, and you prefer potential donor?
Well, it sounds like mining. And I think that when we separate people by a label, whether we call them human subjects, I also do a lot of writing on research ethics, and when we refer to people as human subjects, that we're putting them in a class that's different from those of us who are doing the research, those people who are actually doing the work. And when we talk about people who are potential donors as prospects, that again we're setting them off in a class that makes it easier to do things to them that we wouldn't do to our peers or our family members.
So sort of objectifies them.
Exactly.
That they're no longer people. I mean, are we going that far? I mean, we all know that they're still people.
Even,
yeah. I mean, like I was thinking of your human subjects. We're not referring to them as people. We're medical researchers calling them human subjects. But in fundraising, I don't know, I think we're warmer people over here on the fundraising side than the medical community.
Well, you know, and to be really honest, a lot of the work that I've done on problems with charities and nonprofits and social service agencies start with the premise that when people think that they're doing good things because they've got, you know, a really good end that they're working toward, that is raising money for an important cause, that's when the warning bell should begin to go off. Because news organizations traditionally don't take a careful look at charities or fundraising because, it all sounds like it should be warm and fuzzy and good thing, and it's good people doing good stuff for the good of society. I mean, how many goods can you get in one sentence? Now, I believe that people who do development work, I believe that people who work in nonprofit tend to be pretty good people because they're sure not in it for the money. So I do appreciate that, but it's the whole path to hell is paved with good intentions that gets to be a problem. That when folks think that they've got a really important end or a really important cause that they're trying to support, sometimes they bend the rules just because they know how good and important the cause is that they're working for. It's kind of an ends justify the means argument.
There's a line in the movie The Big Chill that rationalizations are more important than sex. Try to get through the week without a good rationalization.
Mm-hmm.
Stretching the rules for a very good cause, when we're talking maybe about you mentioned breast cancer or hunger or working with the disabled. It seems pretty easy to do.
Right. Well, and let me, you had said something before break about whether I was saying that you were devious, which I wasn't in that case. But let's talk about deception for a minute, just because this is one of those areas where, in my work over the years with development folks and fundraisers from various sectors, not just higher education, this is one of those areas where people think, okay, they've got a potential donor. And I'll just bring an example that just comes to mind from a capital campaign, as a matter of fact, some years ago.
All right.
So there was a donor, potential donor, providing a whole lot of money for a university to have a building built that would carry her husband's name, her dead husband's name. And, you know, and that was great. That was all, everyone agreed completely with that. But this woman also really, really wanted a family fountain in a particular spot on campus. Well, the fundraiser working with actually there were more than one fund, but the development people who were working with this potential donor knew that in the long-term scale of things, that where this woman wanted the fountain was not going to last more than about 10 years. Because if you look down the line, you know, there were other buildings that were going to go up on campus, and this pristine spot that she loved and her husband had loved was not going to be that pristine spot anymore. Due to the age of the donor, the folks at the university decided that this particular donor would most probably be long gone by the time, you know, the campus changed in a way that would make her unhappy. And so they decided that it was safe just to let this potential donor believe what she wanted to believe. I find that unethical because, again, this woman is doing something that is supererogatory. It's something that is ethically ideal, to use different language. She's doing something that she doesn't need to do. And I think that there's a special obligation of the organization that would take her money to make sure that she knows and really understands everything that she would find relevant to the giving of her gift.
Damn, I think I would, I don't know, that one really shakes me. I would like to think I would quit over that if I was on that development team and we were told not to reveal that the fountain isn't going to last more than 10 years or
something. Well, but why? I mean, she'll never know the difference.
It's just wrong. To try to be a little more articulate, it's just wrong. Because she's making a gift under a set of assumptions and conditions that the other side knows are false. That's why. It's almost, I don't know if it rises to the level of legal fraud in the definition of fraud in statutes, but I don't know. It gets pretty close to me if it doesn't cross that line. I think that's touching on fraudulent.
Well, actually, in the way that it was laid out in this particular situation, I mean, the building was going up with the husband's name on it, and it was going to be a lovely building and, you know, a lovely and permanent mark on campus for sure. The fountain was by far, you know, a smaller, you know, seemingly incidental, not very important gift, at least from the university's point of view. And they were going to put the fountain in. They just knew that the woman thought that the fountain would live on forever.
Yeah, well,
they understood it wouldn't.
Yeah, they know something that the woman doesn't. In sort of contract terms, to me, that's a material term that the organization is omitting. Now, I'm taking it out of the ethical and putting it in the legal, but to me, that's a material term that they're omitting. To me, that would be the same as you're renting an apartment and there's lead paint on the walls, and you don't reveal that. That's
okay. All right. Let me give you a different scenario.
All right.
Because it's the same kind of issue that comes up, but it's a very different set of facts. So we have another donor, and the donor wants to give money for the university, and the donor tends to be kind of old school, and really doesn't believe in co-ed dormitories. Now, for any number of reasons, the university knows that before long, even though there's no specific thing on the books right now, but before long, all the dorms at the university will be co-ed. And so, again, is that information that has to be given to the potential donor? It's a change that every university is making. And some folks, in fact, some people at the particular university I'm thinking of said, well, we can't deal with all of the prejudices of all of our donors, and we can decide what's relevant for the donor to know and what's not.
We got to go away for a couple minutes more. Danielle stays with us, and I hope that you do too.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Liebowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
Have you ever considered consulting a roadmap when you feel you need help getting to your destination? When the normal path seems blocked, a little help can come in handy when choosing an alternate route. Your natal chart is a map of your potentials. It addresses relationships, finance, business, health, and above all, creativity. Current planetary cycles can either support or challenge your objectives. I'm Montgomery Taylor. If you would like to explore the help of a private astrological reading, please contact me at Monty@MontyTaylor.com. That's Monty, M-O-N-T-Y, @MontyTaylor.com.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Podcast pleasantries going out to everybody who's listening to the podcast, wherever that might be from, whether it's iTunes or elsewhere. There's podcast.de. Lots of people listening to the podcast in Germany. Wherever you might be listening to the podcast, pleasantries out to you. More live listener love, Pompano Beach, Florida, Tustin, California. Welcome, Angele, France. I hope I did that well. Bonsoir. We've got Germany listening live. We've got Kuwait listening live. We've got the Netherlands listening live. And I said Quebec. Yes. Live listener love to all our live listeners. Podcast pleasantries wherever and whenever you might be listening to the Time Shifted show. Denny, I've got some more listener questions that came in. I got one from, this is from Rory, asking about corporate branding. How much of a charity's brand is it ethical to sell, she puts sell in quotes, to a company? We might be comfortable with logos and branding at fundraising events, but do corporate logos have a place in, say, university classrooms?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and I would it comes down to me particularly. And I'll just take it from higher education, although I think we can extrapolate from that. But I think that the core mission of an organization, and I know this will sound naive, but I think that that should remain pure in a certain way. That is that one should be able to conduct the mission of the university without having corporate brands on everything associated with the mission, but that it is okay to brand things that are external. Here's an example. At my university, in my department, next year we are starting a new graduate certificate program in food writing and photography. Now, we are not selling the sponsorship of that program, but we do have an annual food conference communication conference that's associated with that program that's open to the community every year, a half-day seminar, and that we definitely are seeking sponsors for. And so there is, I think, a sense of ancillary sponsorship. But it gets complicated because if we look at breast cancer charities, as an area of where I've done some particular research, that we have situations in which some breast cancer charities exist because of their corporate sponsorships, and the relationship between the charity and the corporate sponsor becomes so tight that individual donors are often left out in terms of not understanding the importance of people giving in a true philanthropic way, that is, just to promote the common good. And that sometimes folks in need of services that are being touted by the charity get left out as well.
I have a related question about taking donations from organizations that are not in direct contradiction to your mission, but still have or maybe perceived to have a negative impact on society. The person asks, says there are some cases that are obvious, like cancer charities not taking money from tobacco companies. But what about navigating gray areas and like arms manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies? She also suggests oil pipeline companies. Are there
right?
What are the issues around those?
Yeah, I think that again gets problematic, and the more complicated our society gets, the more problematic it is. I do appreciate cancer charities that won't take tobacco money, for example. But at the same time, if they take pharmaceutical money from certain pharmaceutical companies, those pharmaceutical companies are owned by chemical companies which release carcinogens into the air. And so the question is how far back are you willing to go? And I think that really what it comes down to for many organizations is that it's a matter of public perception. That if a cancer charity doesn't want to take money directly from an organization that's known to be cancer causing, but if you take it back one or two generations in terms of corporate ownership, then nobody knows. I think that that's not okay. I think that that there should be limits in terms of donations that people take, but I think that that needs to be stated, because when we come to individual donors, in my experience, fundraisers and charities are quite willing to take money from folks, whether they just want to give out of the goodness of their heart, or whether they're giving for the tax break, or whether they're giving to repay back some private sin. So if an organization is going to refuse money on the basis of how that money was made, I think that needs to be stated clearly and transparently.
We have to leave it there. Denny Elliott is a director and professor in the Department of Journalism and Media Studies at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg. Denny, thank you so much for being a guest.
Yeah, it was fun. I'll buy you lunch.
It's been a real pleasure. No. I'm not putting myself in a compromising situation. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, it's been a real
Bye.
Pleasure. Thank you. Next week, Karen Worcester is executive director of Wreaths Across America. They have grown their volunteer support enormously by being hands-off and supportive. We're going to talk about your building that volunteer base. Maria Semple is back. She's the prospect finder and our prospect research contributor. We'll talk about the DISC assessment tool to figure out whether your potential donors are dominant, influencing, steady, or cautious. DISC. I'd like to be all four of those. So I'm wondering if I can manipulate the assessment. Our sponsors. Rallybound is a sponsor. They make simple, reliable, peer-to-peer fundraising software. Friends asking friends to give to your cause. You get a discount as a nonprofit radio listener. You can find them at rallybound.com or just call and talk to Joe McGee. He's the person who will answer your questions and give you advice on setting up your campaign. And I've met their CEO, I've told you before, Shmuley Pinson. You can reach them, as I said, rallybound.com or 888-767-9076. Welcome to TBRC Cost Recovery, our newest sponsor. Yosef Rabinowitz is the CEO there. So we have sponsors, Yosef Rabinowitz, Shmuley Pinson, Sam Leibowitz on the board. Mazel tov. I love this. Yosef, what he does is we'll go over your past phone bills looking for mistakes. And when he finds those mistakes, and he does over 90% of the time, then he fights the phone company to get your money back. Talking about errors, services you didn't order, and what he also finds is well above market pricing and gets you the money back. And you only pay him if he actually succeeds, if he actually gets cash back. Otherwise, you don't pay him. I've known Yosef for close to 10 years, and I have many times referred friends and clients to him, and I'm very comfortable referring him to you. It's tbrc.com or 212-644-9000, which could also be 644-9000, but I like 212-644-9000. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is our line producer. The show's social media is by Deborah Askenaz of Community Organizer 2.0. And the remote producer of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio is John Federico of The New Rules. This outstanding music you're hearing is by Scott Stein. I hope you're going to be with me next Friday, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern at talkingalternative.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you a female entrepreneur ready to break through? Join us at Sexy Body, Sassy Soul, where women are empowered to ask for and receive what they truly want in love, life, and business. Tune in Thursdays at noon Eastern Time to learn tips and juicy secrets from inspiring women and men who dare to define their success. Get inspired, stay motivated, and define your version of joy and success with Sexy Body, Sassy Soul, every Thursday at noon New York Time on TalkingAlternative.com.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
I'm the aptly named host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. Fundraising, board relations, social media. My guests and I cover everything that small and mid-sized shops struggle with. If you have big dreams and a small budget, you have a home at Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Fridays, 1 to 2 Eastern at TalkingAlternative.com.
Are
Are you concerned about the future of your business or career? Would you like it all to just be better? Well, the way to do that is through better communication. And the best way to do that is training from the team at Improving Communications. This is Larry Sharp, host of the Ivory Tower Radio Program and director at Improving Communications. Does your office need better leadership, customer service, sales, or maybe better writing or speaking skills? Could they be better at dealing with confrontation, conflicts, and touchy subjects? All are covered here at Improving Communications. If you're in the New York City area, stop by one of our public classes or get your human resources in touch with us. The website is improvingcommunications.com. That's improvingcommunications.com. Improve your professional environment. Be more effective. Be happier and make more money. Improving Communications. That's the answer.
TalkingAlternative.com.